who was the friend of God. Bless this time now, in Jesus' name, amen.
I think Jerry's exaggerating. I'll have you guys out of here by probably 1:15, 1:30 latest, max. It is true that we have, there is far too much for us to discuss this morning if we were to look at all of chapter 20 and 21. So I'd like for us to just kind of dip into each of these chapters and highlight a few things. But before we go into this at all, I want to remind you of something that I said a few weeks ago when we were discussing chapter 15. The New Testament, or the New Covenant, often helps us to understand the Old Testament, or the Old Covenant. Now, we often see instances in the New Testament where the Old Covenant, or the Old Testament, is brought in, and it sheds new light, new understanding on what the Old Testament says, the characters, the incidents, the history there. It helps to illustrate the doctrinal truth that is sometimes communicated to us through the epistles. And so, as we look at this morning, that's certainly true. If you remember a few weeks ago when I was talking about chapter 15, I said that there is a relationship, a very direct relationship, between what was going on in Genesis chapter 15 and the doctrinal truth that's found for us in Romans chapter 3 through 8. Now, this morning, we're going to be looking at chapter 20 and 21. Now, 21 particularly is very important because it's related in the New Testament as being an allegorical truth. And we're going to come to that a little bit later on as we go through this section. Before we get to Hagar and Ishmael and Sarah and Isaac and all of those things that are going on there, we're going to look first at chapter 20. Now, there should be a verse. Let's have this verse. Go on. Let's have this next slide. You have an outline that you can follow along with this morning. Now, this is the verse I'd like to remind you of. This is found in 1 Corinthians. These things were written as examples for us. Now, keep this in mind as we go through chapter 20 and 21, because not only are these things true historically, but there is a very deep spiritual significance for us today as we look at what happened back then and how it relates to us and how we go about our daily lives today. Very, very important. These things are written for our instruction. They are examples for us. It's very, very true. So keep that in mind as we go through chapter 20 and 21 this morning. But let's go on to this next slide. Here's the first key idea I'd like you to remember from chapter 20. Neither profound spiritual experiences nor personal ethics will immunize you from making bad choices. Let me say that again. No matter what your spiritual experiences are, no matter how many spiritual experiences you have, no matter how mature you think you are, no matter how good your personal ethics are, these things in and of themselves will not immunize you from making bad choices or from falling into sin. Now, Abraham's been largely absent from our narrative so far. Chapter 19. In chapter 18, we saw that it says in 33, it says, he returned to his place. It focuses on Lot and on what happened in the cities of the plain, Sodom and Gomorrah. And Mike was very kind in how he explained this to us and brought it all out in great detail. And what happened with Lot? Now, that was the focus of the last couple of chapters. We're going to come back to Abraham now, but he's been kind of absent in the narrative up to this point. Now, the last time we see him in chapter 19, he's kind of overlooking the plain. He's standing up in this place. He's overlooking the judgment of God, kind of the smoke and the what's left of the cities after God has destroyed them. And it really is an illustration of how a man of God, a man or a woman of God, can really rise above the judgment of God, not just because of who they are, but because of what God has done in their lives. And here's Abraham. He's standing in this high place. He's overlooking the judgment. It's all finished. He really didn't have to take part in that. He's in a sense above all that. And this really should have been a high point for him. And it is, in many senses, this is a really high point in Abraham's life. It's a pinnacle for him. Now, you might think that Abraham was moving on to higher levels of spirituality and growth. After all, up to this point, most recently in the narrative, what had happened? He had entertained the angels, right? They had come to him and he had treated them well. He had interceded before God on behalf of the city of Sodom. And he had, in a very real sense, he had saved his nephew's family. He had interceded before God and the angels had brought them out, really. Because, what did it say there? It said that God remembered Lot because of Abraham. He was the intercessor. But here in chapter 20, we see something going on that we really wouldn't have expected. Here's Abraham going back into the same old problem as before, flight and fear. See, Abraham goes from the high to the low, and it happens rather quickly. From his dwelling place near these high oaks of Mamre, back there, in, he goes down to Gerar. From standing before the Lord in verse 21, here he is standing before an unbeliever. From overlooking the judgment of God to being judged by an outsider. From interceding from sinners to being rebuked by a sinner. Now that's quite a fall. How does he get there? How does this happen? What sequence of events lead him to this place? And what does it mean for us? Well, let's look again at verse 1 and 2. Now Abraham journeyed from there to toward the land of the Negev and settled between Kadesh and Shur. And he sojourned in Gerar. Abraham said of his Sarah, his wife, "She is my sister." So Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. Now let's start with this idea. Everyone, no matter who you are, everyone is capable of foolishness and sin. It doesn't matter where you are in life. It doesn't matter how spiritual you think you are. You are capable of sin, and you are capable of foolishness. Now here's Abraham doing the same thing he had done 30 years before. He's down in the land of Gerar, just above the Gulf of Suez, on the way to Egypt. We don't know why Abraham decided to leave Hebron, but it was spiritually and strategically important, the fact that he had left that area. Now, Hebron was very important for Abraham. It was important for his family. It was important because of some very significant things that occurred there. God had promised Abram a numerous legacy. It was there that Abram had built an altar and worshiped the Lord. It was there that he jumped off to go and help his nephew Lot in that war, those kings, that coalition of kings. It was the place where God had changed the name of Abram to Abraham. It was the place where the three angels met with him. Very significant spot. You see, God had met with him there. God had blessed him there. And yet Abraham left that place and he went down closer to Egypt. Well, here's something. You can easily get into trouble when you leave the place of God's blessing and move closer to the world. That's exactly what Abraham did. Now, I don't know why he left. Maybe he was upset by what had happened in the destruction of the cities of the plain. I would imagine that the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah was a very messy business. The stench of burning, the smoke of destruction. The only thing I could compare it to was perhaps what happened just a few years ago in this country when some people flew those planes into the World Trade Center. Now, those of you who saw the films and you were watching this unfold on television, you saw the smoke and you saw the stench and you realized that almost the entire area of Manhattan that was occupied by these buildings was covered with smoke and dust and dirt. And it was like the sun was blotted out. And it may have been something like that when these cities were destroyed. A terrible thing to see. And maybe he just wanted to get away. Maybe he was tired of that. But for whatever reason, he left. But I want to make a point here. Let's not make the mistake that his move was simply geographical. We might be tempted to apply this in certain situations and say, well, you're here now, you're in this place, you're in this city, you're in this church, you're in this geographical area, and therefore you can't move because if you do, you're going to lose the blessing of God. It would be wrong to say that. Maybe there are other reasons why you would move, but this move is not just simply a geographical move. You see, for a believer today, the favor, the blessings of God are not necessarily associated with certain places. I have some pictures here on this slide. Let's have that next one. Now, here's some places that people in the world think to be very sacred. They're very special places. In other words, if you go to these places and you participate in what's going on there, you receive special blessings from God. And those of you who understand what those are, you can recognize what they are. I'm not going to talk about all those things. But sometimes we believe that the blessings of God are associated with cities. They're associated with shrines. They're associated with temples. But for the believer today, God's blessings are not associated with places. It's not a geographical blessing. God's blessings are associated with His people. They're associated with His presence. And God is present with His people. Most specifically, He is present in His Son. And we receive the blessings of God and the greater blessings because we are associated with His Son. And we experience those blessings in a practical way when we are associated with the people who love His Son. I mean, why else would we enjoy coming and being in a meeting like we are today, listening to the Word of God, associating with people that we may not see during the week? We love that. We enjoy that because these are people who know and love God in the same way that we do. We experience that practical blessing of being with them because we know that Christ is in them just as He is in us. That's how His blessings are associated, not in places like this. Now, we understand there's a direct relationship between a close fellowship with the Lord and our ability to make wise choices, right? When someone is not walking in fellowship with the Lord and they're making choices, we often wonder if those choices are correct because they're not walking in fellowship with God. Now, the other side of the coin is true as well, right? When you're not walking in fellowship with God, when you're moving further and further away from God and from God's people, therefore your decisions may not be as good. And this was true in the life of Abraham. When you live close to the world, you're more likely to succumb to fears and to fall into sin. Now, we saw this very clearly illustrated in the life of Lot, right? Here he moved closer and closer to the city. He was living near the city, pitched his tents. Next thing, where is he? He's living in the gate. He's in the gates of the city. Now, Abraham didn't make that grave of a mistake, but still, he's moving closer and closer to the world. And here's the next thing, B on your outline. Proximity to the world is proximity to sin. Now, I say this, but most of you may say, yeah, well, we know that. I understand that. I know that. I already understand that that's a spiritual truth. But think about this. It's not just what Abraham was moving away from. It was what he was moving closer to. And that's the danger that I see in some people's lives. It's not what they're moving away from. It's what they're moving closer to. They're getting closer and closer to the edge. In this case, he was getting closer to the world as represented by Egypt. In all of the Old Testament, Egypt is often a picture of the world and worldliness. He's getting closer and closer. He's also closer to those who are the enemies of God. Now, the first thing that he does when he gets there is what? He tells a half-truth about his wife again. He wants to protect himself because he says, well, there's no fear of God in this place, so I guess I have to lie about my wife again to protect myself and to protect her. Well, concerned about his own safety, he relapses into his former lies and these sort of feeble excuses. And just as happened before, 30 years before, by the way, 30 years ago, he did the same thing. Sarah's taken by another man. Now, Abimelech, he's the king of that area, and there's a beautiful woman there. She's not married, at least so he thinks. Now, it's the right of kings. He says, well, there's a beautiful woman there. I'm gonna add her to the harem. She's very pretty. Saw her going by. I've heard about her. Very beautiful woman sojourning in the area. She's not anyone's wife. Why not? Right? I'm the king. Do what I want. So he takes Sarah, inserts her into the harem, along with his other wives and concubines. Now, Abraham's sin results in the same dilemma as before. The point is that Abraham should have been flying high. He should have been on this pinnacle of spirituality with all these experiences that he had had. And yet he succumbs again to the fear of man and puts himself, his wife, and his future in jeopardy. God had given him protection. He had given him victory. He had given him these wonderful spiritual experiences. But these things did not keep him from sinning. Now, how often does this happen to you? How often is it that you are sailing along and things seem to be going very well? You're really walking with the Lord. Things are going great. And then suddenly you find yourself falling into some kind of sin. You find that you've made some kind of a choice that you really regret. Is that possible? Well, yes. Because we have spiritual experiences will not make us immune from making those bad choices sometimes. Now, here's the second thing on your outline. Number two, your poor choices and your sin can have a dramatic effect on others. Look at what it says here in the passage. God is speaking to Abimelech. He comes to him in a dream and he says, you are a dead man. You are dead. Now, we say that, don't we? We say that. I've said it many, many times. What happens when you don't study for your test? Oh, I am so dead. I didn't study for my test. Really? You're going to die? Oh, I am so dead. I stayed out too late. I am so dead. My parents are going to kill me. Right? Are your parents really going to kill you because you stayed out a little too late? Probably not. Probably not. You may wish you were dead when they get finished with you. But no, that's not going to happen. But in this case, it's very true. God says, you have done something with that. If you are to bring this to consummation, if you are to take this thing all the way to the end, in other words, if you're going to take this woman to your bed, you are dead. You will die. You will be judged. I will take your life away. God comes to Abimelech in a dream. He warns him about this peril. Now Abimelech says, well, it wasn't my fault. What does he say? I love what he says here. And this is very, by the way, this is very Eastern. This is very African. Now, Gary mentioned that we spent a lot of time in Africa, and I really saw the sense in which this Middle Eastern African culture comes out in what Abimelech says. He says, the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands. Is that really true? No, not really. But really, we can't say that he was a completely sinless man. He was a fool. But he was an honest fool, right? He had some sense of integrity about himself. He really didn't mean to do what he was about to do. So this is number A under that. Your sin can cause harm and distress to others. Remember that. Think about that. You see, even when we think clearly enough about our behavior, even when you think clearly enough about the consequences of what you're doing, which we don't often do, I mean, I know I don't. When I've made poor choices, I'm not sitting and thinking about the consequences of my choices. But even if you did, even if you thought about the consequences of what that sin is in your relationship between you and God, that it would somehow break fellowship with God because you've made a bad choice, because you've chosen to sin, we don't often think about what the consequences are on others. That's the last thing we think about. But here, what happened? God had to visit Abimelech in a dream. And by the way, this was not pleasant. This was not a pleasant experience. I've had bad dreams in my life. I've had terrible nightmares about things happening. You want to know what one of the most scariest things is for me? I probably shouldn't be telling you this, but I'll tell you anyway. One of the most frightening things for me is I have this dream, a recurring dream, that I come here to church on Sunday. I come to this service, and, Jerry Edinger, he's up here. He's given a great introduction, and he's greeting everyone. And he says, and our speaker this morning is Roger Raybuck. And I had no idea that I was. You can't imagine the terror that brings. You think that this is easy to do this, but it's not. It's not that I'm afraid of speaking or of teaching the word, but I really have to prepare. I mean, I work hard at it. And so if I'm not prepared, if I haven't spent the time to prepare, I would be terrified to get up here and just off the cuff say something because I really would be afraid that I'd say something foolish or something that's incorrect. I really need to think about it in advance. So that terrifies me. God comes to Abimelech and he's scared to death. It was clear that he was terrified. And when Abimelech goes, even the story of what had happened, when he tells others, they are scared. It says the strong men in his camp were terrified. Now, what does this say about Abimelech? First of all, that Abraham was wrong. Because Abraham said, there's no fear of God in this place. Boy, was he wrong. There was fear of God in that place. He didn't realize it. And maybe Abimelech himself didn't even understand. But once God manifests himself to Abimelech, he said, this is a bad thing. And I'm in a lot of trouble. He was terrified. God wanted him to understand this peril. But he had also, at the same time, the text indicates that there was some sort of affliction that had happened to both Abimelech and his family, that there was no conception going on, and there was some kind of a health problem that was occurring because he had taken Sarah into his family. So even though Abimelech had integrity and honesty, he still acted foolishly. You see, integrity is good. High moral standards are good, but they will not keep you from doing something foolish. You still can act foolishly. You still can sin. And had it not been for the influence of God, this man would have plunged even deeper into sin. And God says that very clearly. He says, I have kept you from sinning against me. I have kept you from consummating this relationship and taking this further than it already has gone. That would have been even worse, he says. Now, there's a very important spiritual principle here that I think we can't, I don't want to go on before I say this. And we see this in the world today, and I think it should give us a sense of soberness, but it also should give us a sense of encouragement. And it's this, that in a very real sense, every day, every moment in this world today, God restrains the effects of sin. God holds back the full effect of sin in the world today. Now, Paul speaks about that. He says that there is this mystery of lawlessness that's at work in the world. And he who restrains, many feel that that's the Holy Spirit, the Spirit of God, that the Spirit of God works today as a restrainer. It's kind of like a very strong team of horses that wants to run away, and the Spirit of God is pulling back on those reins all the time. And we don't see the full effects of sin. We don't see all the terrible, awful, tragic things that could occur if God was to let go of those reins and let sin have its full force in the world today. Now that should sober us, but it should also encourage us to realize that if it was not so, probably many of us would not be here today. We can all look at our own lives and we can think about the foolish, stupid, ridiculous, sinful things that we have done. And I could say I'm one of them. I've done some very foolish things in my life. And I believe very strongly that God restrained the effects of that sin in my life so that I can still be alive today. And I think that's true of many of us. And brothers, I don't know about many of the sisters because I don't talk to them as much as I do the men. But I'm looking out here and I'm seeing some faces and I'm realizing I know these guys. I've talked to them and I know what they've done. They've done stupid things like I have. And God has held back the reins. He hasn't had us see that. At certain points in history, maybe the reins are let go a little bit. Maybe we do see those full effects. And it's horrible, isn't it? Think about the Holocaust. Millions of Jews killed. You don't even have to go back that far in history. 1993, Srebrenica massacre in Bosnia. 25,000 people killed. 1994, in Rwanda. 700,000 people killed. Does God restrain evil in the world today? You bet He does. You bet He does. And we should be encouraged. We should say, God, I am so thankful that You restrain evil, that You have not allowed me to see the full effect of those sins and my own sins in my life and in my family and in my experiences. Let's go on to this next section. Abraham is suffering the reproach of Abimelech. Abimelech calls him and says, "What in the world have you done? What were you thinking? What is this all about, Abraham?" You see, your sin can bring about shame and rebuke. Now, as a Christian, I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands. As a Christian, have any one of you ever had the experience in your life, as a believer, to have someone come and say to you, "What were you thinking? What were you thinking when you did that? Why did you do that? Did you think that was a good thing to do?" Why in the world would someone who says they are godly do something like that? You ever had that happen? I have. I've had that happen to me. Has it ever occurred that someone else has had to call you to account for wrong behavior and for sin? Have you ever had to be rebuked or corrected by someone else, even by someone who's an unbeliever? Have you ever had to say to yourself, "What in the world got into me? What was I thinking? How could I have done this? I thought I was more spiritual than this. I thought I was more mature than this. I thought I was past this. I thought I was beyond this in my life. You ever had that happen? You understand that sense of self-realization and the remorse that comes when you realize your own spiritual weakness and your failure. Brothers and sisters, you are still capable of the worst sin that you have ever committed and more. You're still capable of doing that. I'm not saying that you should do it. I'm not saying that God is honored by that. But I am saying that you're capable of doing it. A very godly man once said, "The old natures never die. They just smell that way." Right? If you've ever had to deal with other people in your life, you know that's true. The old natures do not die. They just smell that way. That was true of Abraham, and it's true of us. And that old nature, it's perverted. It can't please God. We sometimes try to respond in the flesh, and the result is sin. The result is some kind of self-righteousness or self-satisfaction. But the beauty of this is because of the sacrificial work of Christ. Because of, for example, what these girls were talking about this morning. The fact that Christ has come to be real in their life. That they have accepted the work of Christ on the cross. They have fully believed that. They've appropriated that in their lives. The Spirit of God comes and resides in us. But then God doesn't try to clean up the old nature. He just says, that part's worthless. I'm not even going to deal with that. That may still be there, but I'm not going to try to revamp it. I'm not going to try to remodel it. I'm not going to try to make it any better because I'm going to give you a brand new nature. And I'm going to work on that one. This old one is worthless. Don't even go back there. No matter how it looks, it is worthless and it always will be. When we fully appreciate, when we kind of grab onto that truth, I think it's revolutionary for us. Because you're freed from that burden of self-effort. You're freed from the burden of just trying harder. Like I said before, it's kind of like the Avis Rent-A-Car Christians. We just try a little harder. Just try a little harder. Just do a little more. But God says it's not that. That's not what it's all about. I think we have to stop feeding this selfishness, this self-nature. Stop protecting it. Stop polishing it up and trying to make it look good. And this leads us into the next section I'd like to talk about in chapter 21. Here's the key idea. Whenever you operate from self, it results in failure. But when you depend upon Christ, it results in victory. If you depend upon yourself, you're going to fail. But when you trust in the Lord, when you depend upon Christ, He will give you the victory. In other words, when you walk in the Spirit, by faith you experience joy. You experience fulfillment. You get that sense of purpose that God always intended for you. But when you walk by the flesh, the result is fruitlessness and failure. Now in chapter 21, we see the results of this life that's lived out. Abraham made a mistake. But look at this, how beautiful this is in chapter 21. Then the Lord took note of Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had promised. Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore to him, Isaac. Sarah said, God has made laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh with me. God had long ago promised a son of promise. He said, this is going to bring joy to you. This is the ultimate fulfillment. Your descendants are going to be more numerous than the stars in the sky. And this is number 3 in your outline. The only way that we're ever going to experience real joy, real fulfillment, is with a life of faith. The life of faith is the only way to experience true joy and true fulfillment. Now, chapter 21 is a picture of the fruitfulness that's promised to the real believer, the true believer. In this case, Abraham. God fulfills the promise. It was long delayed, but God had a purpose in delaying. Through these trials, through these mistakes that Abraham made, he was learning a lot about himself and he was learning a lot about God. What God expected of him. Victory, fulfillment. Now this is A, under number 3. Faith, a life of faith, means that you trust God to do the impossible. Now I notice how often this passage confirms the supernatural working of God. I really wish we had time to examine all of these phrases in detail, because I think there's just a whole lot of beauty here. But just very quickly, he says that the conception and birth of Isaac was supernatural. How many times does he mention in there? Abraham, oh, he's 100 years old. Sarah, 90 years old. The one whom Abraham had, the 100-year-old guy, whom Sarah bore to him, who was 90. I mean, how much does that speak of the supernatural, the absolute unbelievability, the impossibility of this thing occurring? Sarah was so far beyond. It's not that Sarah was 40, or 45, or 50, or 60, or 70, or 80. It was ridiculous. It was way out there. 90 years old. Yeah, God's going to do that. He's going to work something that's impossible. He's going to do something supernatural here. Why? Because he says, that's the only way you're going to know that it's only me doing it. It's not you. Ishmael, that's you doing it. Isaac, that's going to be me doing it. And I'm going to prove it to you because it's going to be supernatural. The timing of it was supernatural. 30 years after God had first promised. What were you guys doing 30 years ago? Where were you 30 years ago? Now think about it for a minute. 30 years ago, my wife and I, we had one daughter. Our oldest son was not yet born. He would be born in just a few weeks. His birthday is on April 20th, so this is March. So Danita was 8 months pregnant with Aaron, our oldest son. I was working as a machinist. I had a beard, kind of weird looking, and I had no idea. I had no idea. Someone had come to me at that time and said, 30 years from now, you will have gone through the interim program and spent 15 years in Africa. You'll have 5 children, one of whom will be born in Africa. You'll have 3 grandchildren. And, you'll have other joys and sorrows in your life, but that's where you're going to be 30 years from now. Really? You're kidding. Do I have to shave my beard to do that? What? Really? Can I just go there now? Can I skip the bad parts and just have the good stuff? No, I'm going to bring you there. That's where you're going to be 30 years from now. Where were you 30 years ago? What if God had promised you something? Unbelievable. This is supernatural. Romans chapter 4, Paul refers to this, and he says, Abraham did not weaken in faith. He said, he looked at his own body, he said, God can do it. God can do it. Now, why would God want Abraham to wait this long? What purpose is served in making him wait 30 years? You see, God was waiting for the abilities and the forces of the natural man to cease. It was only then that God's promise could definitely be a supernatural fulfillment. When Abraham stopped doing things his own way, God could finally step in and do it right. You've seen that happen in practical ways in your own life, right? You see someone trying something. You know, I mean, I see Alan Embrecht. He's sitting out here this morning. Alan's very good with his hands. He's a wonderful craftsman. Alan was helping me one day work on some plumbing in my house, and I was struggling with it. He had brought this special tool over. I'm trying to cut this thing out and made a cast iron. And I'm messing around. And he's standing there looking at me. He finally says, are you done? You know, it's kind of... I mean, the sense is, if you're done messing around, let me do it right. And he was absolutely right. I said, yeah, I guess. So Alan can say, he cuts the thing off in about 30 seconds. He's all done. Done, thing in, it's all finished. Oh, you know, call it a professional. Right? Get somebody who knows what they're doing. And God is saying, are you done? Are you done? Because I'd like to do this right now. If you're finished, let me do it. Okay? Abraham. And that's exactly what God says today about the fruit of the Spirit. Brothers and sisters, this is what God is saying to us. Are you done? You want the fruit of the Spirit? Well, okay, you're striving and you're trying and you're working and you're doing all these things. Do you have the fruit yet? Do you have the Isaac yet? No. Okay, well, let me do it. You know, because I'll show you how good it can be if you let me do it for you. It doesn't come from self-effort. It doesn't come from positive thinking. It doesn't come from the perpetual trying that we often indulge ourselves in. You can imitate the fruit of the Spirit, but you can't produce the fruit of the Spirit by the flesh, can you? It just doesn't come that way. It comes from the supernatural indwelling of the Spirit of God in the life of the believer and Him working this thing out. And what a beautiful picture between Isaac and Ishmael, God saying, I will give you Isaac, I will give you the blessing, but you got to let me do it. You got to stop trying to do it on your own. And this is B, underneath that outline, faith is rewarded with the joy of fulfillment. Isaac means laughter, and this whole household is filled with laughter when this son is born. Now, what a picture that is. And when we finally let go, God says, I will give you that fulfillment. I will give you the joy. I will give you the Spirit. Now, the story doesn't end here. I want to just finish with this. I know our time is spent, but let me finish up with just the last couple of things on this outline. There's a sharp contrast in the next section of what happens. On the day that Isaac is weaned, there's a great feast. And there's a conflict going on between Sarah and Hagar. There's some jealousy. There's some bitterness. There's some anger. Sarah says, send away this woman and her son because she can't inherit this. She can't be here with this son of promise. And amazingly, what's actually kind of startling to us is that God says to Abraham, do what your wife says. Not that his wife can never be right, but we think, well, isn't that kind of harsh? I mean, it isn't. Isn't Ishmael Abraham's son? Isn't that his son? Yes or no? Yes, of course he is. So, what's going on here? Why would God want Hagar and Ishmael to be separated from Abraham's family? Now remember what I said earlier. The New Testament instructs us on the Old Testament. And here's the idea. Number four, the life of faith, if you're going to live a life of faith, it demands that we divorce the covenant of law and we embrace the covenant of grace. And that's exactly what's happening here. Now, the Epistle to the Galatians helps us to interpret this. Paul's making the argument to the Galatian believers that the only way to please God is by faith. You can't do it any other way. And he uses the life of Abraham as an example. He says, here is a man who pleased God by faith. Abraham believed God and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. That's the only way to do it. It's the only way we've ever been able to do it. It's the only way you will ever be able to do it in the future. You trust God, you believe Him by faith, and you receive the righteousness because of your belief. And all of those who believe God in this way are true sons of Abraham, it says in Galatians. Now, in chapter 4, you don't have to turn there, Paul uses the history of Abraham to illustrate another aspect of this. And that's why this is important for us today. How do we live according to this new covenant of grace? He says, listen, these two women represent two covenants. There's Sarah and there's Hagar. Sarah represents the covenant of grace, the new covenant of grace. Hagar represents the old covenant of the law. He says, here, God does it. Here, you try to do it. Here, God is acting and interceding on your behalf by grace. He is sending His Son. He's brought a new covenant in His blood. And here, here's the law. You try to do it on your own and see if you can be righteous enough. Here's the two covenants. These two represent it. Now, it's important because Hagar was what? She was a slave woman. She was an Egyptian. Every child that Hagar had was what? A slave. There couldn't be anything but a slave. She could only bear slaves. She could not have a free child. They would always be slaves. Sarah, on the other hand, was a free woman. She could only have what? Free children. So, I think you begin to see it, right? You see what God is saying here? You see, true faith, this is A, true faith can never mix law and grace. You cannot do it. Hagar, the old covenant of the law, can only have slave children. And Ishmael was the product of the self-effort. It was Abraham saying, I can do this on my own. I can follow some sort of rules, and I can make the promise happen. God says, no. You're going to have a son, but it's not the son of the promise. Whereas Sarah, the new covenant of grace, can only have free children. And it says in chapter 4, verse 28 of Galatians, it says, we are all free children because we are children of Sarah. Because we are what? We are born under the new covenant, not under the old covenant. You see what they're saying here? See how beautiful this is? It makes such perfect sense when we take this history and we allow the New Testament to interpret it for us. But Jesus spoke of this same thing when he was challenged by the Pharisees. They wanted to compel him and his disciples to follow the forms of the law. Jesus said what? He said, you don't take a piece of a new garment and you put it on the old garment. You don't do that. No one does that. You don't take new wine and you put it into old wineskins. He said, who would do that? That's crazy. You don't take the new covenant and try to put it into the old covenant. And you don't take the old covenant and you try to put it into the new. You say, this is old. This cannot coexist with the new. And that's exactly what's happening here. The new covenant of grace completely supplants and replaces the old covenant of the law. Now, for us who are believers, and for anyone who has not believed, this is a very important spiritual truth. Because if you believe in the redeeming grace of Christ, you must set aside any self-effort and man-made solutions. You've got to set it all aside. There's no room in the same family for grace and law. One's got to go. And law and legalism are always going to be at odds with grace and mercy. Right? Those of you who know, those of you who interacted with others, and you go to someone and you say, I have believed on the Lord Jesus Christ. I trust in His finished work on the cross for the salvation of my soul. There's nothing that I can do to merit that. I believe in what He's done, and I know I'm going to heaven because of His work that He's accomplished for me. What do most people say? Just get out of here. Why? Why do they say that? They say that because they're living under the law. They're saying, that can't be right. I mean, you got to do something, right? You got to work for it somehow. You see how law persecutes grace? Just like Ishmael persecuted Isaac, law continues to persecute grace, and they cannot coexist. If Isaac... Well, let me just close with this, because our time is finished. Let me give you an application of how this might work for you today. Isaac represents the fullness of the Spirit of God in the life of a true believer. The joy, the contentment, the realization that God has finally delivered His promise. Here it is. We live in the light of that. We say, I have this joy, I have this peace, I have this contentment, knowing that God has fulfilled His promises to me. He's fulfilled His promises in his Son, Jesus Christ, and we receive, in a supernatural way, the ability to give back these gifts of the Spirit, in a sense, the fruits of the Spirit, to others. We live out that life, and there's joy, there's peace, there's contentment. Now, if Isaac represents that for us, what does Ishmael represent? I would like to submit to you this morning that Ishmael represents, for every one of us, those things in our lives that are some kind of a pet manifestation of the self-life that we don't want to let go of. You see, when God came to Abraham and He said, it's time to let Ishmael go, what was his response? He wasn't very happy about it, was he? He said, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know, Lord. This is very grievous to let this go. I don't want to let the one who I know is not the son of promise go. I don't want to let go of that thing that I created of my own will and my own self-effort. I'm not willing to let go of that, Lord. You see, true faith means, and this is B, final thing in your outline, true faith means that you must trust God to cast out your Ishmael. Do you have an Ishmael in your life? What's your Ishmael? Perhaps it's some sort of long-standing habit you've been defending. Maybe it's a pet position. Maybe it's some kind of pet idea that you have that you feel that you are right about and no one else understands. It could be a friendship. Could be a membership. It could be anything. Anything that we allow to arise in our lives because of self-indulgence, the things that we protect, the things that we justify, the things that we delight in, just as Abraham delighted in Ishmael. God says it's time that they went away. Abraham had known from the beginning that Ishmael was not God's choice. And it was a very hard thing for him to let Ishmael go, but he knew that God was saying it's time for Ishmael to go. And maybe in our own lives, sometimes God places something in your heart or in your mind. He said, it's time for this to go. This thing cannot coexist. If you want to continue to enjoy my blessings, if you really want to enjoy the blessings of the Spirit and the life of faith that I want you to have, this has got to go. It's got to go. I don't know what that is. I don't know what it is for you. But maybe you could think about that this morning. And let me finish with this. And I think this is the most beautiful thing about what God says to Abraham here is that God never asks us to give up the Ishmael until He gives us the Isaac. See, God gave us Isaac first. And then he says, now, there's something here. You see the blessings. You know the truth. You understand the joy that you can have. Will you not give up this Ishmael for my sake? Because it can't coexist. If you want to see the blessings, you want to see the growth, you want to see the joy, it's got to go. But he's given us the Isaac first, hasn't he? You know, Jesus has come. The Lord has come. He has paid the price for us. And he says, what are you going to do? What choice are you going to make? Now, these chapters go on. They talk about the well of promise, the well of contention, and the well of peace. And I wish we had time this morning to talk about it, but I know we don't. But there's a great wealth of joy and happiness in here. But I think it's important that if you take away something from me this morning, realize that we all have this, we all have an ability in our lives. We are all still sinners. And we can make bad choices. But God wants to give us blessing. God wants us to understand that He is willing to do what He has promised. But maybe there's something standing in the way of receiving those full blessings from God. And I just want to ask you this morning, think about that. Is there an Ishmael in your life that you need to send away? And I just pray that if that's true, you'd consider what that is this morning and really give that over to God. Let's pray. Lord, I thank you this morning that you are so gracious to us. You are patient with us as you are patient with Abraham.